Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, Movie Geeks United is on the air this Wednesday night, May. What's the date?
Today's the 19th, Jamie.
Today's the 19th, okay. How's everyone out there doing tonight? We're glad to bring you the show. Man, some exciting stuff happening with the show lately.
Yeah.
All right.
No, there is a lot of exciting stuff. There's a lot of exciting stuff that's actually happened since the last time we were on the air. Something happened since the last time, since our interviews that we did earlier today. Some big, upheaval in Hollywood in one sense. Megan Fox, it was canned from Transformers 3.
You're burying my first story, dude.
I'm sorry.
All right. Some exciting stuff happening for the show lately. we're planning a tribute, a retrospective tribute to the summer of 1985. And in doing so, we've sent out all these invites, and we've gotten several responses back. So those of you that don't follow us on Facebook and our guest bookings, it's going to be a series that we're going to play throughout the month of June, and we have guests like...
Steve Gutenberg.
Yeah, from Cocoon. A good 8 minutes with him.
Great. Way to just destroy it right there.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. And Dana Wheeler Nicholson from Fletch. Joe Dante, famed director, acclaimed director. Of course, that year he did Explorers, which was the first movie with Ethan Hawke and one of the first with River Phoenix.
That's right.
Harold Faltermeyer, the musical identity of 80s cinema, at least
yeah,
80s
sure.
action cinema. Help me out. Who else? Alexandra Paul from American Flyers.
Don't forget Bob Gale.
Bob Gale and Leah Thompson for Back to the Future. Just endless amounts of great shows, and we just got Savage Steve Holland. Now, what did Savage Steve Holland do in 1985, Jerry? Here's the trivia question for you.
Oh, well, that's, I want to say One Crazy Summer, but I think I'm wrong.
Oh, you're close. He directed Better Off Dead.
Better Off Dead, that's right. Okay. Now, was that the summer or was that the fall? I forget. What was...
That was August.
Okay, cool. That's a great movie. That's great.
Yeah.
If you were going to talk to him, that's awesome.
Lots of people just adore that movie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dude, that's a great quotable movie.
And, man, I got offered the strangest assortment of guests this week that I've responded to for us.
Mm-hmm.
How's this for a duo? Joan Rivers and Ron Jeremy.
Dude, that'd be awesome, both of them. Let's do it. But I'm curious, what's Ron Jeremy for?
He's got a movie coming out. Lily Sobieski's in it. Something about Bliss. I'll look it up. I'll find out what it is. I have it here somewhere. But
his memoir is great, and the documentary about him. I mean.
Oh yeah, the documentary's great.
Yeah, the book. His memoir is very good. He's lived. I mean, he has lived an incredible life. Ron is like I think every guy who listens to this show, and girls too. I mean. He is like, you know, everyone knows who Ron Jeremy is. Everyone sort of also, like, when he went out, he flew out to Paris to be in Killing Zoe for what was it, a couple seconds of footage.
Right. Finding Bliss is the name of the movie that Ron Jeremy is in. And also the cast and directors from The Crazies, which is coming out on Blu-ray and DVD,
hey, that's
of course.
A cool film. That's a cool remake.
I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah,
I've heard great things about it. And Anton Fuqua, Brooklyn's Finest.
That was a very, you know, speaking of Ethan Hawke, that was a very interesting movie. Didn't get
yeah.
it too. Did not get
yeah.
it too, but it was very, very fascinating.
So let's talk a little bit about news. We're gonna get to our guests tonight, the screenwriters of some really high profile picks that are coming out this summer and in the future too. I mean, these guys have it made. Prince of Persia,
yeah,
and The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yeah, I mean,
that's just this summer, and then they're working on National Treasure 3, and I try to drain a scoop out of them about that film. So those screenwriters, Doug Miro and Carlo Bernard, will be joining us a little later on in the show. Okay, I wish we had like breaking news music.
Well, this is,
but you already broke it.
I already broke it because, you know, it's like when news breaks, we fix it. You have a Daily Show tagline.
Right.
But, no, Megan Fox, I mean, she's been all over the place in news-wise. I mean, I know Jonah Hex coming out in, like, next month, but she, I guess all these comments she made about Michael Bay finally caught up with her. And I guess this interview on Allure doesn't help things either, but didn't help things, but... He basically, Michael Bay fired her, and now the hunt is on for a new love interest for Shy. But he's also in the news lately.
Yeah, and do you think more of him for what he said?
I think more of him on a personal level for his feelings about the film. Professionally, I don't know how smart that was to say that, especially about Spielberg. I really don't know. That's the
yeah.
kind of thing you say, you know, in the back room or at a part at the like in the behind the scenes. I don't think you should say that in an interview. And I'm not saying it just to be nice or anything. I'm just saying professionally for your career, those
especially
kind of
since Spielberg has been so kind of instrumental in nurturing Shia LaBeouf's career.
Oh yeah, I mean here's the thing though. Here's the thing. We just saw what happened. Now I'm not in no way comparing Michael Bay to something that Spielberg would do. But we've seen what happens when an actor
right.
or actress says something about a director they work on, especially in Megan Fox's case. Michael Bay really did make her, regardless of what you want to say. He made her what she is.
Right.
I think to say these things, and what's interesting about the Shia comments is it almost seems like he's taking all the criticism of the movie, like if you listen to our show or if he read all the talkback sections on all the websites, it's almost like he's trying to gain favor with the fans directly, in one sense. But the fans don't sign his paychecks, you know?
Right.
I know it's a horrible thing to say, but I don't know. Professionally, I just don't know how smart it is. Now, what will happen to him, I don't know.
Well, he kind of bad-talked Transformers 2 as well.
Yeah, everyone
said,
did.
He said Transformers 3, the script is a lot better. But about... Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, he was interviewed at Cannes where they premiered Wall Street 2,
mm-hmm.
which we'll talk about in a little bit.
Okay, yeah.
And he made a statement that he said, he said, you get to monkey swinging and things like that, and you can blame it on the writer, you can blame it on Steven Spielberg, but the actor's job is to make it come alive and make it work, and I couldn't do it, so that's my fault. Simple. But he didn't stop there. He said that everyone kind of dropped the ball on the movie, and the movie didn't work, and he's not the only one that feels that way. That Harrison Ford has expressed to him that he feels the same way, which, you know, he's giving his opinion.
Right.
That's the only part of the interview that I thought was potentially not great of him, because he's speaking for someone else, you know, something that Harrison Ford would be diplomatic
would
enough
never,
to never say.
And I'm curious what, you know, I'm sure one of Alan Harrison read that or heard that he was just like, oh my God.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how things work out there. We do know how things work out, but I'm just saying, I don't know with Spielberg, I don't know what, you know, we can't gauge right now, but I would never just I would just keep my mouth. It's like saying something about like writing about your job or something on a blog or something. You're saying your boss is awful or something, you know.
Yeah.
It's along those lines, on a smaller scale, in the sense of us if we did it. But here, this is. I honestly was shocked when I read that. I understand what he's trying to do. I think everyone understands what he's trying to do. But look, the movie's 2 years old. It's gone. Well, maybe not forgotten, but you just let it go.
Yeah, I suppose so. But you know, I kind of like that he was that open.
And I
don't think it's going to affect anything for his future career.
No. I mean, I just think. Professionally, I think going personally, I think yeah. I mean, more, you know, that's great. You know, cool.
Yeah.
I mean, but yeah, we'll see. I don't think it's going to hurt him the way it is. It's not like he said anything as crass as Megan Fox, obviously.
Right.
So
yeah, he essentially said Spielberg. You know, he's made enough classic movies that he can take one, a hit for one movie that he
yeah.
made that didn't pan out.
True.
But Wall Street 2 did premiere there, and to generally, I didn't read a single negative review of it.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody says that it's fun, and almost universally people are saying it falls apart in the third act.
I wonder what happens in the third act. That...
Well, I know, but...
Oh, you know, okay.
What I'm wondering is, how did they not know? How does anyone that... And Chris made this point to me in private conversation the other night. How does anyone that watches that trailer not know? It's the whole aspect of, is Gordon Gekko redeemed or not?
Mm-hmm.
My argument, and all you have to do is read a review to find out what the third act thing is, but without revealing it right out, even though most people could probably guess it, my argument is, who wants to see a movie about Gordon Gekko where he's gone good?
True.
I mean, one of the deliciously villainous characters of the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you want to see. You want to see a return to that. And no one plays a weasel like Michael Douglas, so let him do his thing.
He made a career of it for a good while there. Before Wonder
yeah.
Boys, he made a career of it. Let me ask you this. I found something very interesting in reading a lot of the coverage of the movie, is that, you know, Michael Douglas almost, I can't believe he was serious about this. So he said a couple of interesting things. One, just dealing with the character of Gordon Gekko, he was always shocked that people walked away with the wrong, like kids, younger people, like my age, our age, walked away with the impression that Gordon Gekko was someone to be admired. He was always
right.
shocked by that. The other thing he said, though, that is not related to the movie so much, but about the financial meltdown, was that it hurt independent films, like to make independent films, and this is true, harder to finance, but he said in one way, in like this almost sinister way, it will get rid of a lot of mediocre independent films.
What
like,
will?
Okay. This the lack of money, the lack of investors and that sort of thing. He
right.
said a lot of mediocre independent films will no longer be made. He was, you know, so I was like, wow, okay, Mike, you wanna go there offering your critique of the indie scene, okay?
Yeah, I mean that's of course true. If there was less money that studios made on their big tentpole movies,
yeah, mm-hmm.
there'd be less mediocre movies made. I mean, it goes all around, and there are just as many mediocre or poor indie films as there
yeah,
are.
Mm-hmm.
movies at the multiplex. So.
Yeah.
Other news from Cannes. It looks like a big favorite 2 days ago was Beautiful,
mm-hmm.
The new film from the director of Babel.
Right.
With Javier Bardem.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that he's a lock for Best Actor, and they thought that it was a lock for Best Picture. Actually, it could still be a lock.
Mm-hmm.
But... if there is such a thing. But the 5.5-hour film Carlos premiered today or yesterday and they say that it is never a moment's boredom in it, that it's the most exciting, wrenching, sexy movie that you can imagine. That's getting raves. But it's out of competition.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right.
Yeah. But so far, that's like a big recent story about Cannes, and it's not even in competition.
It really sounds like the Michael Lee movie is the one that's getting the most positive feedback. Another Year, I think it's called, or
yeah,
that's getting a lot of good. That was the first thing that was actually picked up for distribution, I think.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't read that, but and then Woody Allen premiered his new film, and they got really, really tepid reviews. They say it's a throwaway Woody Allen, kind of aimless Woody Allen movie, which is a shame because, like every Woody Allen movie, it's such a great cast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anthony Hopkins, Naomi Watts, Josh Brolin, Antonio Banderas, you know, Frida Pinto, like on and on.
No, he's always got like of the moment. He always has the, of the moment, the hottest actors and actresses.
Woody Allen also made news at Cannes because...
Oh, God, here we go.
He came out and spoke up in defense of Roman Polanski, to which I'm sure Roman Polanski said, damn it, it's just not my week.
Well, yeah.
He said the old argument, he's a kind man, he's a great artist, leave it alone. Don't like that argument. You know?
Yeah, and coming from Woody...
Well, it, coming from anybody, it makes no sense to me.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So that was carried internationally.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
those quotes resounded. Hey, let's do something interesting on the air.
Okay.
Oh, by the way, this is a good segue to this interesting thing that I'm about to do. As I often do, I Google Movie Geeks United, and sometimes I come across some real pearls about us that people post. It's generally good stuff. I found a negative review of Movie Geeks United from some poster of a message board. It was in response to a question, what podcast do you listen to? And this user said, Dallas Cowboys-related podcast, but I only listen to those during the season or NFL draft, or sometimes in preseason. I don't listen to any other movie podcast, though. I tried listening to Movie Geeks United, and it almost put me to sleep. I don't know why I find that so funny. Every time I read it, I laugh. I love that. So we're sorry we put this gentleman to sleep.
I blame myself for that, whatever... episode that was. It's me.
But
yeah,
in keeping with that, I'm going to open up a fortune cookie live on air and read my fortune.
Oh, shit. Here we go.
This is good radio. See, there's suspense in this and, you know, the unexpected.
Dun, dun, dun.
Live out of your imagination instead of out of your memory.
That's pretty good, man.
All right. And now I'm going to proceed to eat the fortune cookie.
On the air.
Am I waking you up yet?
Yeah. Wow. There you go.
That's
great. We have great sound effects.
Just know that, you know, this thing was posted August of last year. Eventually, we will find your comment. And whether it's good or not, we'll read it on the air.
Yeah, we'll read it, definitely.
At least you gave us a try.
Yeah,
that's great.
That's good. That's better than, you know, some other people I can think of. But, yeah, thank you.
What else is going on? David Fincher going to do 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea?
I mean, he's doing that. But, you know, are they all dead set on this remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo?
Oh yeah,
he's gonna direct. I love the movie, and the books are good, and the second and third movies are coming out. I don't know if we need to remake it that soon. I mean, I love Fincher.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, but I mean, it's just. But yeah, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. What do we think about? I mean, it could be. I don't know. I think that's due for. I guess all these things are getting remade. I guess it's gonna be in 3D and everything.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm sure it will be.
I mean, yeah.
I'm behind anything Fincher does. I'm not excited about that project, but
yeah, I mean, it's Fincher. Like you said, we'll watch anything he does. He's a very meticulous, he's a visionary. I don't want to use the Maverick word because I think that word was killed in the last election, so I don't want to use that. But he is a visionary. I think he always will be. So yeah, I'll watch anything he does.
Yeah. What else is happening? Do you know of anything?
I'm just trying to think if, we brought up Polanski earlier, and this is obviously, You had brought up a story on Facebook, and it was about Charlotte Lewis from the Golden Child.
Yes.
And why did she wait? I mean, does anyone know why she waited until now? I mean, this happened, obviously, on the set of Pirates.
On the set of Pirates, well, yeah, I'm kind of fuzzy on that, too, because she said it happened before Pirates. I don't know. I'm fuzzy on it. But either way, she claims that around that period of time, Polanski molested her. Or, yeah.
Okay.
In the worst possible way, which that comment didn't make sense either, because she said that she, from what she said, she went through with it because she needed the money for the job. Because she and her mother, a single parent, were living, you know, under poor conditions, and it was important to her, the money.
Right.
And the worst possible way sounds like, you know, the girl 40 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anytime I see Gloria Allred, or whatever her name is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You're not alone in that. A lot of people. Yeah.
Trotting out with someone. I know it's, you know, for nefarious publicity purposes, but... I don't doubt the veracity of what she says, but I don't know. I don't know.
No, I just thought that was because when I saw that, you posted it, and I went to look at the article, I was like, oh, dear.
Yeah.
I
did post. Man, this is a really relaxed show tonight. We're trying to put
well,
everybody
you're eating
to sleep.
A fortune cookie on the air. I mean,
Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, since we were talking about it earlier, is it due for a reassessment?
Yeah, I saw that, and everyone sort of like went out and like basically like took the was going to crucify you for that.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying that it is. I'm not saying. I don't know that it is. I'm just.
No, but I'm just curious. Well, what prompted you to? Did you watch it again?
Yeah, I did watch it again.
And any does it get better or?
No, it doesn't. Actually,
okay.
I have the same opinion of it that I had the first time I watched it. There's 20 minutes for me that. Really work in that Spielbergian magical way. But the response to my question of is it open for a reassessment essentially was, no, are you insane?
See, that I don't agree. I don't agree with that. I think everything's open to a reassessment or, you know, anything. Your mood, maybe you were, you know, it really is, it depends what kind of mood you're in, and that goes for everybody. What, you know, and if you go back and watch something a couple of years later, sometimes, hey, and if you hated it, you might actually warm up to it. Or sometimes you'll be like, what was I thinking? Why did I like that as much as I did?
Right.
You know, these things happen. So I think a lot of things are open up to reassessment. I think to look at it, the only one I don't think I could ever really, because I initially did like it, and then as I thought about it more and more after the day, is The Phantom Menace is that I can't watch because it's so boring.
Right.
I mean, if that was the first Star Wars movie, if that was actually released as it was, it just drags. I mean, so.
Well, there is something to be said for those kinds of movies, like Kingdom of the Crystal Skull certainly was, that everyone is so waiting in such with such bated breath and such anticipation for it that when it lets you down because it's not the experience that you wanted from it,
right? Of course,
you tend to vilify it a little more extremely than. Your average movie.
Right, that's true.
So maybe a couple of years' distance from it would be helpful in reassessing it.
I think so, especially if they're really going to go ahead with the fifth one.
Yeah. And then that'll be made in about 4 years, and another 6 years Shia LaBeouf will bad talk it. So that sounds
well, that's the whole
work.
Thing. Will Shia return with that, or will the fifth one open up? It was just all a bad dream.
Right.
Yeah, that never happened.
Have you seen any movies? You saw Robin Hood, right?
I saw Robin Hood, which is, I don't know. As I said, the first 90 minutes are really slow. My brother was like, what do you mean the first 90 minutes? It's most of the movie. I said, well, no, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes long. So it does, by the third act, kind of get interesting. But I will say this, and we talked about this earlier, you know, the film is essentially a prequel to the Robin Hood films that we know and love, with Errol Flynn or Patrick Bergen or even Costner. It takes place before he was Robin Hood, so this is like how he became. This is everything. I think if it was so much shorter and if they maybe had a clear-cut thing of what they wanted to do, it might have been better. I mean, is there, if I'm not mistaken, this was originally going to be told from the Sheriff of Nottingham's point of view. It was going to be called Nottingham several years ago before they went along with this storyline. There was going to be, I think Russell Crowe is going to play dual roles as Robin Hood and the Sheriff of Nottingham, which would have been basically, I guess, the equivalent of Greta Garbo's Two-Faced Woman and probably would have met the same box office fate as that. But it's just not. I actually really now want to go back and watch the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven, which I've had for years and never gotten a chance to watch.
Right.
But and I hear that's actually really good. And I like Ridley Scott and Russell Crowe when they work together, but these last two efforts, this and Body of Lies, have just been incredibly disappointing.
I actually enjoy Body of Lies. I like watching it.
Well, it's better than this. I mean, no, it is. I was just like kind of disappointed in that one. I thought DiCaprio was very good in that, and I thought Mark Strong stole the movie in Body of Lies.
There's an argument being made on I think it was Movie City News. There was an article being written speaking about reassessment. Is Ridley Scott one of the most overrated directors there are? He has his skills. He's better than most. But how many classic films has he made? I mean, how many truly great films has he made?
His first three films are really his masterpieces. The Duelist, Alien, and Blade Runner, I think, are his masterpieces.
Right.
I love Black Hawk Down. I like Matchstick Men.
Yes.
I love American Gangster. Help me out here. I like Black Rain.
You do?
Yes, I do, with Andy Garcia and Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
I do like Black Rain. Now, what are some other, name me some other ones, though. There's some other.
Well, Gladiator.
I like Gladiator, but I'm not smitten with Gladiator. Actually, my favorite Russell Crowe performance, I think, is
Well, you know, you're missing a big one from Ridley Scott. It's probably the biggest one he did outside of Alien and Blade Runner, and that's Thelma and Louise.
That's one I like a lot, too. And, I mean, the reason I didn't mention Gladiator is I like Gladiator, but I just always compare it to Spartacus, and Spartacus, to me, is the better movie. I like Gladiator, don't get me wrong, but I don't think it's that. Like I said, one of my favorite Russell Crowe performances, I think, is Master and Commander, and then Romper Stomper. But there's another – here, let me look. There's another movie. I don't know if it's him. If it's not him, then I'm going to keep quiet. But this is – but I do like him. I don't – he – See, I thought it's after Blade Runner, because Blade Runner was not a commercial success, that his career sort of, drifted for a while in the mid to late 80s. Legend was a dud. And that's another film that a lot of people, it has a very strong cult following. Am I still on the air?
Yeah, but for whatever reason, he had... Still on the air.
No, I wasn't hearing anything, dude. This is all right. Let me just see.
Jamie, I'm so used to you interrupting me.
No, a movie that I like a lot is White Squall. I like that.
Yeah.
But there's there's Hannibal. There's Kingdom of a Good Year, which is
a bad movie.
Yeah, a bad year. But I do like Black Hawk Down. But is he overrated? There's G.I. Jane.
I don't know. I don't know. But it's personal perception. I don't think he deserves the title of one of our one of the greats necessarily.
Well, I didn't know he was considered in that vein, because there are a lot of people like this person in Movie City News. There are a lot of people who, I guess, since Gladiator, have like said he's overrated. I mean, this isn't a new argument. This is
no. I think that he's regarded as an artist. In the deep sense of that word.
Okay, all right.
The most pompous sense of that word, in relation to in relation to his brother, who makes adrenalized popcorn movies.
Right.
More and more, the more they go on with their careers, the more similar they seem to one another in terms of the quality of what they produce.
No, there's a lot. You actually bring up a very good point, because that was something that. Someone had said about Body of Lies seemed more like a Tony Scott film,
right?
In many ways. That's a very good point. They are becoming more and more Although I don't care, man. If Tony Scott at least did Robin Hood, there'd be a lot of explosions and everything.
Yeah, and there'd be lots of freeze frames with titles all over the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah. I don't know what to think of these.
His movies are really busy, Tony
busy?
Scott.
Busy? That's an understatement.
He is consumed, unlike us, with not putting you to sleep.
Yeah. You know, but that's an interesting point. You know, I know a lot of people have a lot of problems with. I mean, I like Ridley Scott a lot. Yeah, I don't know if I put him in a league with some of the other people. You know, like you said, when you use that word, no, I wouldn't do that. But I do think those first three films are pretty perfect to me, at least. And then after that, it's I don't.
Alien,
know.
Blade Runner. What was the one before
that?
The
first one,
the Harvey Keitel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
His films
are
beautiful. Let's put it like that. He does have a very good eye.
That's his strength. He's
his
visualist.
Strength. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, I would give it visually. That's his big thing is the visuals. The arguments against everything else. Yeah, I can see that. Totally.
I think he came up from commercials. If he had come up 10 years later, or a little longer, he would have come from music videos. Like
that's right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Which essentially The Hunger is, which is Tony Scott's film.
I love. I actually think that's one of Tony Scott's best films. But and one of the.
Oh my God!
Movies.
You can't get more atmospheric and moody than that.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great film.
Yeah. Okay, let's get to our interview. Actually.
Mm-hmm.
Prince of Persia opens. This weekend? Is it this weekend?
And Memorial Day. It's Memorial Day weekend. Next weekend.
It's Memorial Day weekend. So the week after this one.
Mm-hmm.
And it stars Jake Gyllenhaal. It's based on a popular video game. And also The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which opens July 16th, is an action adventure starring Nicolas Cage. Mike Newell directed Prince of Persia.
Wow.
John Turteltaub directed Sorcerer's Apprentice. And it's written by our two guests tonight, both of those films, Doug Miro and Carlo Bernard, who also wrote a John Dahl film, The Great Raid, and the DreamWorks movie, The Uninvited,
right.
which I like The Uninvited.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working on National Treasure 3 right now.
Okay.
And we discuss all of this and more with them in this interview. Here is Doug and Carlo. I wanted to start out by asking how this collaboration started between the two of you.
Well, Doug and I we've been friends since second grade, so we've known each other, you know, at this point for like 30 years, over 30 years.
Yeah,
we
grew up together in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So we've known each other since we're kids, and then basically we've been writing together for like, what is it now, like 12 years or 10 years or something?
Yeah, 10 years.
10 years?
We sold our first script in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And so we, you know, that was a spec script. We got some buzzing, sorry. That was a spec script we wrote, sort of, you know, not the smartest way to start on, hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah.
I think somebody's line is okay. It's better now.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm outside, but I can hear everybody.
Okay, we just got some feedback there. We wrote. So we knew each other, you know, all the way through high school. We're close friends. Went separate ways for college. Rejoined each other here in Los Angeles, working various jobs. I went to USC Film School and joined Carlo working, and we were working in the same place and wrote a script there. As we worked, and that script was an adaptation of a book that Carlo liked and found, actually set in Detroit in the 50s. It was a film noir set in Detroit in the 50s, the absolute most unlikely thing to write for your first script and actually sell it. And we were very, very lucky and didn't even, I think, know our luck. We sold that script to Warner Brothers. It was then George Clooney's company. And that was sort of our first springboard, and we got from there, that script kind of didn't go anywhere, and we got a job at HBO, which kind of didn't go anywhere, and then we got to write The Great Raid, which was our first credit.
The John Dahl film.
Exactly.
Right, yeah. It was sort of the end of the old version of Miramax.
Well, I'm curious about a couple of things. Essentially, you guys grew up together. If you've known each other for 30 some odd years,
yeah.
What were your cinematic tastes? What movies did you both enjoy?
We're both definitely of the, you know, we're right in that sort of sweet spot of the Star Wars. You know, Star Wars when you're 6, Indiana mm-hmm. Jones when you're, you know, whatever it is, 10 or 11. So obviously those are, you know, massive touchstones for us and for almost anybody of our generation. Those are definitely major ones. And then I think, you know, we obviously have individual tastes, but I know that we also have always been big fans of, you know, Bridge on the River Kwai and Lawrence of Arabia. And we're just real fans of that sort of, you know, classic, muscular, character-driven,
right.
You know, great filmmaking. I know that those are, you know, for us, those are the main ones that we sort of try to tap into, you know, with the stuff that we do.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're big fans of classic Hollywood and, you know, yeah, forged in Spielberg and Lucas and then expanding out to David Lean and Hitchcock and, you know, those. I mean, my memory, strongest memory of the first film I saw was Vertigo and just what an impression that made on me. And then after that, it was like the movies Carlo was talking about. I mean, particularly Spielberg movies.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't ask for better influences.
Yeah.
Your David
yeah,
Gatop
no.
one.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Those are good ones.
Yeah. Yeah. I think something about, I think we're, you know, something about that stuff. You know, we're just Midwestern guys. You know, so that's all stuff all feels so spectacular and fresh. You know, to us.
Yeah.
Well,
they're magical movies. I mean, they put the magic in the medium. Those movies that you're mentioning.
You're absolutely right. That's the key. Is they gave us that magic we were looking for, and you know when we went to the movie theaters.
Yeah, tell me because this interests me when I speak to co-writers or co-directors or co-anything. How does it work practically? What's the process that you guys have when you write a screenplay together, or is it done together in the same room?
Our process has evolved. We used to sit down and write everything together. Obviously we'd outline together first, and then we would sit down and write together. And it's kind of evolved a little bit. Actually, part of the reason, part of the prompt of the evolution was Persia, where because Doug and I were on set every day of shooting, which took place in Morocco and London, and we both have family, so what we did is we ended up sort of really kind of trading off, where one of us would be on set for a couple of weeks, and the other person would be in L.A. So then we sort of started more, like, writing pages and trading them back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So our process has kind of evolved a little bit. And now we're at the point, I think, a little bit more where we outline together, which for us is very important and a very sort of, you know, intense and significant part of the process. And then we'll sort of, you know, divide stuff up, write pages, trade the pages, and then sort of tend to rewrite together. For us, it's like outlining is very important and rewriting is very important. And those are things that we try to do together, you know, in particular.
And then ever so often we have a cage match at the end of the day.
Right, right.
Get out.
Or at the beginning of the day.
Yeah.
It's been a tough week.
Yeah, just to get out of the aggression.
So, Prince of Persia, my understanding is that the creator of the game, Jordan Mechner, is that
yeah,
right?
Mechner. Uh-huh.
That he pitched it to Bruckheimer, and at that stage, did Bruckheimer approach the two of you?
No. We were involved later in the process. Jordan was really clever. He sold the game rights to Ubisoft, but kept the film rights and sold them to Jerry with John August's help. John August vouched for Jordan so Jordan could write the first draft of the screenplay because usually they won't, you know, let anybody who's not a screenwriter do that. But Jordan, you know, got to write the first draft, and then there were a couple writers that followed him, and we followed them. So we were actually a little down the line from Jordan, but we've gotten to know him pretty well. He's a great guy. So, we were the fourth of a set of writers.
And then we were constantly on it for like 2 years. So it's been in development for quite a long time because we've been on it for, you know, yeah, like literally over 2 years.
Yeah, what's interesting is even though we're the fourth of writers, we fundamentally changed almost everything in the script.
Right. Well, did you work closely with Jordan? Because I know that the game, he built a, you know, an expansive story around the game, and he wanted it to be different from the experience of the game.
Yeah, you know what, I'm perhaps overstating. Jordan was responsible for a lot of great story ideas in ways of, you know, translating the game to a film. Like, he knew that that in order to make a film out of the game, it had to be something different. And that he needed an ending that was spectacular, and he needed more than just game levels, and he needed, you know, plots, big turning points, and characters that were a little richer. But he also had a good starting point with that game. It's as games go, it has a pretty incredible story. You know, it's a period romantic sort of grand drama that, you know, games don't usually have.
Well, when I'm hearing you talk about your influences, the Raiders of the Lost Ark and the David Lean pictures, did you guys call upon that kind of inspiration when you were writing this one? It seems right in line with that.
Yeah, for sure. That was definitely one of the big things that got us excited is when we talked to you know, Jerry about doing the movie. They, you know, initially, to be honest, before we even read the script, or at least speaking for myself, I was kind of hesitant because I thought of most video game movies as being, you know, sometimes just not really working or feeling slightly sort of, you know, corny sometimes.
Right.
But, you know, when we met with Bruckheimer and his team, they made it clear that they really wanted this thing to be, you know, a big, muscular, you know, and visually lavish world, and really it would feel, you know, like David Lean doing a Jerry Bruckheimer movie, you know, which to us was, you know, really exciting and sort of the best of both worlds. And yeah, I mean, Jerry definitely wanted to do this thing with very, you know, very high level design and really spectacular visuals and really create, you know, a world that nobody had ever seen before on film.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you guys have been working on it for over a period of 2 years. And writing, you know, I find writing very painful, and I would think that the rewriting process must be painful as well. Do you ever run the risk of
writing
kind of losing?
Painful.
Yeah, it's all painful. Do you ever run the risk of losing sight of the forest through the trees, or how do you do that?
You definitely do. I mean, that's one of the spots where I think it helps that there's two of us. To be honest, there's definitely days where you know, I'll feel like I'm not exactly sure, you know, what we're doing, or it's one of the spots where it's helpful to have someone else there because everybody kind of reaches their tipping point at a different moment. So it's good to have someone else there who can be sort of like the designated driver if you've kind of lost the, if you sort of lost it for a moment. You know, at least speaking for myself, that's helpful.
I think also, you know, with film, it's so important, and especially given what, you know, we were saying our influences are. Those guys are great storytellers. Their stories are relentlessly surprising. And the only way something is relentlessly surprising, you read it over and over again, and you feel like each time you read it, you're still surprised by those big story turns. And, you know, to get it there, to feel that way, you have to keep doing it. You have to keep looking at it and keep saying, how could I make this more surprising here? How could I have the audience not be expecting this? Because I expected it. I kept in, you know, this time when I read it, I saw it coming too much, you know. So it helps to, like, keep at it, and that's the way it becomes surprising.
Right. Now, is Sorcerer's Apprentice, that's a Bruckheimer project as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Production? So yeah. Tell me a little bit more about Bruckheimer, because he seems to have this magical formula down. I mean, he's such a tremendous success. In your conversations with him, how expressive is he about what he wants from the material?
It's funny. I mean, people talk about, because obviously everyone that you meet with always kind of wants to know how Jerry does it. And the assumption is, and I had the assumption too, before working with him that there is maybe some kind of, you know, formula or whatever. But it's funny when you actually are inside the process, you really realize that it's really a lot of hard work, you know, and there's not necessarily a kind of magic formula. But I think what Jerry is really good at is Jerry, more so than I think anyone that I've ever worked with, really always sort of has the audience's interest, you know, in mind, and he really has an ability to experience the screenplay in a way that the audience is going to experience the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's definitely a skill set that he brings that I have found to be really unusual and really helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, he always says, I want to be able to just sit back with my popcorn and be told a story. And story is really king for him. And you feel that in all phases. He just wants the story to be clear and have a ton of momentum and be surprising for the audience. And that's really a guiding principle for him.
Well, I guess that's probably the secret of a good producer. He never loses... or any creative person on a film, they never lose the perspective of that audience member that they're making the movie for.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially with what we do, it's so chronic in Hollywood that people can often make it about them, but Jerry never loses sight of his audience, and the audience is always first and foremost in his mind. It's always what he's thinking about. Even when you see him in public talking, he deflects attention from himself. He wants it to be about entertaining people. That's what he enjoys. And he's also, another thing a great producer does is they let their people do their best work. You know, they find ways to help everyone around them to do their best work. And they encourage it in small and subtle ways, and they make those people feel good about what they're doing. And Jerry's good at all of those things. You know, he doesn't interject himself so much that, you know, you feel like it's about him as you work. That's also a really important aspect of a producer.
And what was, comparing it to the Prince of Persia experience, what were the unique challenges with Sorcerer's Apprentice for you?
Well,
we came on later in the process, and that was a slightly different process because they already, you know, we're building sets and you had locations. And so we were sort of trying to do work a little bit more within the construct of, you know, locations and existing sets. Whereas in Persia, we were really kind of a little bit more free to create stuff because we were on the movie at an earlier stage.
Mm-hmm.
That was definitely, every product's different because there's a different context and Sorcerers, you know, yeah, we came on at a later stage in the production.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, but with Sorcerers too, there was a little bit of discovery still going on with the movie when we came on. So what was interesting with that was it was very late and they were still sort of, they were already into production or into pre-production where they were building things, but they were still, at the same time, we were still discovering exactly what the tone and identity of the movie would be. So
mm-hmm.
that was different. And and also some of the characters and fleshing out who they were. So doing that under that kind of pressure was a totally new experience where it had to get done and it had to be done quickly and it had to be right the first time out.
Well, you guys have rewritten previous drafts of scripts, and I'm sure you guys have had experience with your writing being tinkered with as well on subsequent
mm-hmm.
drafts. Is that difficult because you're so invested in it, and yet you can't be too precious about it?
Yeah, I mean, that's really the nature of being a screenwriter, or at least, you know, a working screenwriter. It's kind of, that's definitely part of the challenge. And what kind of helps is the stuff that Doug was talking about earlier with Jerry, and that Jerry makes it kind of really clear that it's not about ego, it's just about sort of making the best movie possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps that you do feel with Jerry that you know there's going to be, you know, a lot of input, but you don't mind it because you really understand that everyone's looking to make the best movie possible. But yeah, I mean that is the nature of the beast, you know, that these things are collaborations. From the very beginning, it's a collaboration between, you know, you and the producers initially, and then finally you and the director, and then it'll become the script and the actors, and then post-production, the editors. It's an ongoing part of the process.
Wow. Did I read this correctly that you guys are working on next National Treasure 3?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, give me a scoop. I got to get a scoop. Tell me whatever you can.
Yeah, well, we value our job too much. As much as we'd like to help you.
Come on, nobody's going to listen to this. It's safe. It's okay.
I don't know. It's kind of reverse psychology you're working.
Right, yeah.
To talk about it. We're really excited about what we're doing. It's different in a lot of fun ways from the past two, but very much the same in all the ways that we loved, because we really love those first two movies. So,
mm-hmm.
It's going to be different, but it's also going to be a lot of the fun stuff everybody loved in the first two movies. You know, the same, similar group of characters, maybe some new, and slightly, there'll be a treasure. I can say that.
And it'll be a national one. So
it'll be a national one, and it's too.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, do you have a timeline when they're looking to get this going? Do you have a timeline to turn in your work, or?
We don't. We have a timeline, which is it's supposed to be turned in as soon as possible. but we haven't. There's no production date that we know of that have been official or anything like that. But.
Well, this would be like the second time after Sorcerer's Apprentice that you're writing for Nicolas Cage. And I'm thinking he has such a unique cadence and way and manner of speaking. You have to take that into account as a writer, don't you, when you're writing for him?
I kind of look at that as his sense of humor. I think that, Balthazar, who he plays in Sorcerer's Apprentice, does speak actually differently than Ben Gates does in National Treasure. In Sorcerer's Apprentice, Balthazar is this mysterious ancient sorcerer who has maybe a slightly arch and peculiar way of talking. And you guess you could say the same thing about Ben Gates. He has a slightly arch and peculiar way of talking, but differently. You know, he's talking about history and something he's passionate about and exposing different clues and truths. Whereas Balthazar in Sorcerers, he's more mysterious and he's more elusive and he's not saying as much. So they're very different characters, but both very much in the wheelhouse of Nick Cage and things he plays really, really well, because he's great at that sort of peculiar, intelligent, funny, interesting characters.
Yeah, and I don't know if this is true, but Doug, are you writing Sharky's Machine for Phil Jawanu? Is that true?
Oh, I think that's like an IMDb thing. Someone else asked that. You know, Carlo and I did a rewrite on Sharky's Machine 4 or 5 years ago, and I don't know, maybe that resurfaced or someone put it on IMDb, but we're not doing that right now.
Yeah, I can never fully trust IMDb. It burns me all the time.
Yeah. No, I mean, if IMDb, we could get some residuals from IMDb, that would be great.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm sorry to backtrack, but Carlo, near the beginning of your career, I have to ask about this because I'm crazy about Michael Mann. You actually worked or assisted Michael Mann on some of my favorite movies, like Heat and The Insider. Can you tell me anything about that experience?
It was great. I mean, working for Michael was amazing, and it was an incredible experience to be able to, watch someone who's really pretty much the best at what he does, up close 24 hours a day. It was basically the most amazing job you could have, if you're interested in movies at all. And Doug, it was around the time of The Insider, Doug, after he finished film school, worked for Michael as well, starting off doing development for him and then sort of, merging into doing other stuff as well. So we were both there for a bit of time, preceding when we sold that first script to Warner Brothers.
Wow. I would give anything to be on the Heat set. That's one of my all-time
favorite films. It was amazing. It was And I would drive Michael to set every day, which was kind of odd because I had just moved to LA and didn't know myself, my way around. and the movie was shot in, like, you know, however many dozens of different locations all over LA, and Michael's always fantastic about finding these really obscure and visually interesting locations.
Mm-hmm.
That, yeah, I was constantly getting lost on the way to.
Yeah. Now, do you guys, one last question, then I'll let you go, but do you guys actually spend time on set for some of these projects that you've written?
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure we were there every day, and, I mean, it just speaks to how Jerry involves writers and how gracious Mike Newell was in keeping us involved. I mean, we were partners. As Jerry says, you know, it takes five smart people to make that big of a movie, and he wanted, you know, ever so often we got to be included among those five people. And so we were there every day, you know, pointing things out if need be, rewriting, touching up scenes if need be, you know, reworking action sequences, that sort of thing, and Persia talking to the actors, talking to Mike. On Sorcerer's less so, because a lot of the writing was still going on as it was being shot, we were actually mostly locked in a hotel room in the Gramercy Hotel in New York, writing scenes so that they would be ready for the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't actually on set as much on Sorcerers, although a couple times we were there and got to see John work and talk to him.
Mm. Well, I'm excited about both your summer movies. It's going to be a great summer for you guys, obviously. But and when it's safe to reveal anything about National Treasure 3, please come back. And we'd love to welcome you back on the show, guys.
Yeah, we can
great.
Give you some clues, and you can maybe figure it out.
That will be in keeping with the theme of the movie. That will be
right,
great.
Exactly.
Right.
All right.
I appreciate it very much, guys. Okay. That is Carlo Bernard and Doug Miro, screenwriters of Prince of Persia, which opens up Memorial Day weekend, and The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which opens July 16th.
That was a really good interview. Those are very fascinating guys. Yeah, they've got it made. I mean, they really
yeah, they really do. Yeah, they really do. This weekend's releases, what's coming
up
this
weekend?
We have
the supposedly the last Shrek movie. They keep promising us that. And,
which I hear is not bad, which I hear
no,
is actually...
No, Michelle McHugh said that. He said it was good. And MacGruber, which I haven't heard, besides that Atlantic Monthly review a couple months ago, I haven't heard one thing one way or the other. So
I wonder if they screen that for critics.
They must. I mean, obviously I know people have seen it, but I really haven't heard much about it though, so we'll see. We will see what happens.
So you'll be seeing both films, I'm sure.
I want to see MacGruber more than I want to see Shrek. I'm probably going to wait
by Friday morning. You would have watched both films.
I would like to think I would have seen MacGruber by sometime Friday, you know, Friday afternoon or something.
Right.
Shrek, I might wait for my niece because there's nothing to see next weekend. So for her.
Well, I mean, Aaron saw it.
Saw
Shrek, yeah, and said that it's really funny. That it's really good.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So they're ending it on a high note, and then I read one negative review of it today, but it was for an online site that I didn't recognize.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, there you go. From Aaron, okay, of all people, that's, wow, all right.
And if anyone empathizes with, you know, that character. What else is coming up?
Those are the big ones, and following weekend is Prince of Persia, and I did see something over the weekend on demand, continuing trying to go through the on demand things, and it's a movie that comes out next week, and I saw Survival of the Dead.
Oh, so you did, you were able to sit through it. I was
yeah,
not.
I don't know, maybe I should have watched Human Centipede instead. That's on demand too. I don't know, but you know, what is it with these guys named George? You're cannibalizing, no pun intended, their own creations to the point of really, I have to
who's
say.
Who's
you
the
know,
other George?
Lucas.
Oh, okay.
know,
sorry.
No, that's all right. That's okay. I I like Die of the Dead. I responded to it. I think it was like perfect or anything. But looking back at both of these, especially these last two Dead films, these would have worked much better as like a half hour or hour long Masters of Horror vignette. than a full
right.
war motion picture. There's just not that much there anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm watching it. Of course, I'm watching it with my dad, who every 5 minutes, someone put money up for this. Someone invested in this. Why? I mean, it's okay, never mind. You know, trying to explain it to him. But, you know, I just watching it.
Well, it's built in. I mean,
there is a built-in fan base. I mean,
and not a lot of money, and I'm sure that they make
profits. That could not have cost a lot of money.
I'm sure they make profits because he keeps having the opportunity to make them.
Yeah,
I don't know how much he struggles to. I think he actually gets financing and then says, "Well, let me come up with another story."
Yeah, well, I liked. I mean, it's one that a lot of people don't like, but I did. I think of the recent ones that he's made. I like Land of the Dead, but now he's making a.
Which one is that? Is that the video one?
That's before the video one. This came out in 2005. This is with Asia Argento, isn't it? And Dennis Hopper is in it. And,
I thought that one came before the videotape.
It did. That came in 2005.
Okay.
But he's remaking. It's very interesting. He is remaking Argento's, I think, Deep Red. That was announced this week. And Argento,
George Romero?
Yeah, and Argento is making a Dracula in 3D.
Ugh.
Yes, I know. So who knows? I don't know what to say, but yeah, I sat through that. And the other thing that comes out next week in the ultimate counter programming movie to Prince of Persia, Sex in the City 2. So, there you go.
yeah. Well, I look forward to your full review of that.
Oh yeah, I'm sure everyone does.
yeah. Yeah, that's right up our alley.
Yeah, that's right. I'll come back and tell you. I'll call you Friday morning.
Right. Right. I watched, I got a movie story. I TiVo'd some stuff I found on, like, Encore. Encore's a great station to look at what they're playing overnight.
Mm-hmm.
They always play these unexpected, you know, so slightly older movies. And so I TiVo'd a lot of things, among them Rocky II.
Yeah, I like that movie.
Rocky II, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it, too. First of all, I'd forgotten that Stallone had directed it.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That he started directing that series from then. And then, and his performance is great in those first two movies.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people don't give him credit. That's a performance.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, I got roused.
Oh, yeah.
Not aroused, but...
First three Rocky movies a lot. I like
three. That's Mr. T, right?
Mr. T and Hulk Hogan, yeah.
Right. We have a call, 310 area code. It might be rolling.
I'm sure it is Roland.
Roland, is this you?
It certainly is.
I love Roland. He never called me, man.
I know. I was going to call you.
Okay, well, call me this weekend. I mean, seriously.
What do you think of the Rocky films, Roland?
Oh, man, I love the Rocky films. I love the first two.
I thought you were about to say I love the book. I was like, what?
I think, we were talking about the first two, and you're right, his acting is, I mean, it's a really good, really good character. It's a great character. I mean, there's no denying that Rocky Balboa is just an awesome character.
The classics, I mean, because of what happened in Rocky IV, and definitely the other one with, I mean, or whatever his name was. I mean, it's kind of tarnished the whole thing. But the first two were great, and then the third one was still really enjoyable as well.
Mm-hmm. But you think the fourth one with Dolph Lundgren was over the top, or no?
I loved it when I was a kid. But
yeah, kids, yeah.
If you watch them back, it's a massive detour.
Yeah, although I do love that line, "I must break you."
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. But, yeah, Capture the Time. The first two, great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm typing to a listener. Okay, I'm done.
I want to hear, though, your thoughts on Robin Hood, though, because we are in complete agreement about that.
Yeah.
You called to rant about the... What was it last week? Iron Man 2. So this week you wanted to rant about Robin Hood.
I think I've calmed down since. I'm just bored. I was just I'm just bored by
it. No, but
it's
actually, since we have you on the line, I wanted to ask you something about Harry Brown.
Yeah.
I saw that finally this weekend, and I like that. But,
oh, good. Where,
no, but yeah. I wanted to ask you if you thought maybe, because we were talking about comparing Kick-Ass to the Iron Man films, and I actually think, I was thinking about this while watching Harry Brown, what you were saying, is I actually think Kick-Ass and Harry Brown is the much more appropriate analogy. Because they're really both about vigilantism and about self-empowerment and about taking the law into your own hands. Now, granted, and the thing about Kick-Ass, though, more so than any other comic book film, is it's, you know, while the producers and writers of, like, Iron Man films and the Dark Knight films say they've grounded it in a certain reality, Kick-Ass is really grounded in a more so reality because it is what the ordinary person puts on the costume with no superpowers, and they are, instead of being the victim, you know, trying to overcome that. And I think that's what's so really incredible in Harry Brown. And I did like the twist at the end of Harry Brown. I did not expect that at all.
Yeah, I think that was clever. Harry Brown really got a bum rap in England. It got politically, it just didn't bode well.
Well, because it was a real statement about, you know. I'm sure Clockwork Orange didn't get it. It got a bad rap in England, too. Actually,
it did.
It really did.
It did, but I thought the film was great. I thought Harry Brown was just great. I thought everything about it. I'm not too sure. It was a bit over the top at the end, but...
Did you see it at a theater, Jerry?
Yeah, I saw it at a theater.
Okay.
Michael Caine was at his best. I mean, best thing I've seen him do since Get Carter, I think.
Wow, that's a long, dude, that's a very long period in between. No, but there's a movie we don't talk about a lot.
Only done 1,000 movies.
No, but he always said he was a working actor. I mean, he always said that he was a working actor.
It's the best thing you've done since the very first thing you did.
No, there is a movie he made with Tom Courtney and Ray Winstone in 2002, I guess it came out here, Last Orders. It was based on a Graham Swift.
Yeah.
I like that.
I didn't see that. I got the DVD for it somewhere, but I haven't watched it. It looked like...
It's a very little movie.
Yeah.
But I liked him in that, but, you know, no one ever talks about that one.
I think if you look at Harry Brown, though, compared to Kick-Ass, the reason why you can't compare them is because one's a small film, one's a big film.
Mm-hmm.
The target audience, I still think, is...
Oh, the target audience is vastly different, but they are really about the same thing at the end of the day. The marketing-wise, no, it would be very hard to...
How about Harry Brown Taken? I think that's a good...
I think Harry Brown is more in line with that because I think Taken, and especially, and to an extent, Gran Torino, but I think a lot of people, like, you know, you said in Britain it wasn't well-received. It's gotten slammed here in the reviews. People don't like it.
Why are we comparing everything to everything else?
No, I just thought it was very interesting. We were talking about last week, and Kick-Ass is definitely worthy of discussion, and it is about taking the law into your own hands, granted in maybe a much more fantastical way than Harry Brown or even Gran Torino or even I think, you know, obviously Harry Brown has a lot of its roots, you could say, with Death Sentence and the Brave One a couple years ago, and especially the ultimate vigilante film, Death Wish.
And the Tom Selleck film, Folks.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there you go.
I don't know.
Definitely.
I've never mentioned that movie on the show before, and I like to mention a unique film on the show,
even if it doesn't make sense. Thank you so much for bringing that up.
Tom Selleck and Don Ameche in a comedy about Alzheimer's. I think the tagline should have been so funny I forgot to laugh.
We're going on the Alzheimer's jokes again.
Anyway, Harry Brown, I can't wait to see it. But also a difference between that and Kick-Ass is from what I've read of Michael Caine's interviews that he's done for Everyone Except Us, it seems that Harry Brown wants to be a statement film. Has something to say.
Maybe.
I don't know. I read some reviewers in this country seem to think that the movie is saying that basically a police state is what the film is advocating. You will feel the safest in a police state in has been some of the conclusions that people have drawn. That's given to the events of the third act of the film, which are, as Roland says, are over the top and disturbing too, I may add.
But there's no doubt the director's trying to capture a feeling, you know, a perception amongst a certain
right
time now, you know.
Yeah.
So,
Roland, I haven't asked you to say this in a while. Iceberg right ahead.
Have you guys already slated Robin Hood, Jerry?
I'm sorry, what was that? I'm sorry.
Man, we changed that subject fast, didn't we?
Slated Robin Hood earlier in the show?
Yeah.
Briefly, what was your problem with it, Roland?
Well, there's tons of problems with it. First of all, the scripts. I mean, this really incredible script writer there. He's done Mystic River and a whole bunch of other things. And the scripts.
Some L.A. Confidential, Payback. I mean, a lot of things.
Who is this? The Gravenese, or who is that?
Brian.
Who did it?
Brian Hedlund.
Oh, Hegelin. Okay.
But the film really. I mean, that's the problem with the film. Really, I don't think the script's so bad you could never save it.
It's just like nothing happened. I felt like the first 90 minutes were a labor to sit through. I mean,
every scene was
kind of like the show.
No, would you stop? Don't let that guy get to you. The show. Jamie was reading viewer mail or listener mail earlier, or a comment that he found on a website.
Yeah.
On a.
And one guy said that our show put him to sleep. So
I've been
harping
than
on
Ambien.
That. Yeah, right. I think we should be prescribed.
You just need to throw in a few more swear words, guys. You'll be okay.
Get me riled up. I like Russell Crowe a lot, and one of my favorite performances is Master and Commander, in recent years. But I don't know this one. Correct me if I'm wrong, Roland, but doesn't it seem that Ridley Scott still has this love affair with the Crusades left over from Kingdom of Heaven with this film?
Well, I can't remember the last good Ridley Scott film. I mean,
Well, that's there's a lot of people who would agree with you there. We were talking about Ridley Scott earlier. I'm a fan of American Gangster, but I know that's not a popular one. I like that one.
Well, he did a good job with that.
Mm-hmm.
I just think if you look at it compared to his earlier stuff.
There's no argument there. I mean.
But with Russell Crowe, even with American Gangster, even with. Didn't Ridley Scott direct Body of Lies?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Even with that movie where I thought DiCaprio was good again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just feel that Crowe's kind of going through the motions and he still wants to act, but I just feel. He's kind of lost his mojo. He seems happy with his life, and I just don't think he's got anything else left to. He's not the actor he was. I mean,
the only great actors are the ones that are unhappy with their lives.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. But,
I understand what you mean.
But what I like about Russell Crowe in Body of Lies is that he is just going through the motions.
Maybe.
I like that about him.
If you compare him to The Insider, I mean, even in Cinderella Man, he was good.
Man. I like that.
I mean, that was the last really decent thing I saw him do, I think. And he's one of my favorite actors.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of hurts me to say. If
I understand what you mean. What did you think of him in State of Play?
Again, he was good. There's nothing wrong with it, and you could say
mm-hmm.
was wrong with him in State of Play, but I just feel like he's just sort of turning up and doing a decent job, you know?
Right, instead of really knocking it out of the park.
Yeah, and with this movie, I think he's really come unstuck because he's not engaged with the character. The script's
mm-hmm.
bad anyway, so he's in trouble. And the voice, the accent's a big problem. I mean...
yeah, well, he walked out of an interview when that guy was giving him a hard time a couple of last weeks or whatever.
I mean, it's a bizarre accent. Is it Irish? Is it English? No one knows what he's doing, but, I mean, that's not the only problem. He's doing that whispery thing as well, like I said to you the other day. He's kind of just whispering all his lines where I feel like he kind of... That's his default mode when he's not engaged.
Right.
Kate Blanchett was fine. I mean, all the, William Hurt was good.
I thought he was a standout. William Hurt, I thought, was a standout in the film.
Yeah, and he's always good.
Mm-hmm.
William Hurt's in it, huh?
Yeah, I know. I said the same thing when I was like, William Hurt's in it.
What the hell?
It's a really fucking weird cast. I mean, it's just weird. The whole thing's just weird. I mean...
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it's got a weird cat.
I'm going to ask you this. I did not know this, because obviously a lot of the reviewers, when I read the reviews, did not know this. Were you aware that this was essentially a prequel?
Yeah, I mean, how is that going to be a sequel? It's such a bomb.
Yeah, I mean, but obviously they're setting it up at the end, you know, for the legend itself to fill. And this was all a prequel, and you're watching it, because, like, I don't think a lot of the critics, when reviewing the film... Because one of the major complaints is there's no reference to this or that, you know, the myth or anything. And, you know, as you're watching it, you're like, wait a second. Oh, this is how he became Robin Hood. Why didn't they say that? No, in no trailer did they say that. No, I mean, that's a very important thing to have left out.
I mean, the only thing I could say about the movie, it was reasonably well. I wouldn't say it was well directed, but I thought the cinematographer had done a decent job, and that was about it.
Yeah, I think you're right there.
But you got to compare it to something like Braveheart, and if you compare it to Braveheart, it's a world apart from it.
Very much. Even Rob Roy, for that matter, I think.
Yeah. And,
so, Roland, who should replace Megan Fox in Transformers 3?
Who should replace who?
Megan Fox.
Oh, well, has she been ditched? She's been ditched.
She's been thrown under the bus.
Is this because of her fallout with... Michael Bay.
He did it. Yeah. He fired her. He got rid of her.
And when did they announce this?
Tonight.
Tonight, actually, yeah.
Oh, wow. That probably is good.
Well, who should replace her? Who are you thinking of? Do you even care? I didn't know this was such a big topic because they're...
I know he absolutely doesn't care. That's why I wanted to ask.
Yeah, I know. Why? I think it should be a porn star. But
anyway.
Well, they already went with Megan Fox.
Yeah, well, that's an insult to porn stars.
Any babe can walk in and do
it. Yeah, I mean, it's not a... They should just go with an unknown.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Hey, Terry Gilliam's Don Quixote looks like it's going to happen, finally.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's going to happen with, Ewan McGregor. And Robert Duvall, so they got the two lead cast members. So
that's an interesting dynamic.
Hey guys, have you seen the trailer for that new Matt Damon, Emily Blunt movie?
The Adjustment Bureau. Yeah, it looks kind of interesting. I'm curious about it. I mean, it's based on a Philip K. Dick story.
One of two of my favorite actors as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Likewise. So I'm very excited for that.
Matt Damon is one of your favorite actors?
Yeah, Matt Damon. He's probably my favorite actor in that crop, in that generation. Him and DiCaprio.
Well, they're both very good.
Him and DiCaprio. DiCaprio has won me over since Gangs of War, because I thought he was a joke. I thought he was a joke in that movie. And I hated him in Titanic, and I hated him in Gangs of New York. But since he'd done Catch Me If You Can,
mm-hmm.
started to win me over, and then he did The Aviator, and I thought he was great.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought he's been great in everything I've seen him since.
Right.
Yeah. They want to make a Wonder Woman movie. They've wanted to for a long, long time.
But who's now going to be Wonder Woman? Who are they thinking?
Oh, I don't know who will be Wonder Woman. And they don't know either, but another director has thrown their hat in the ring, and that's the director of that movie Bronson that came out.
The guy who did Bronson? That's a great... I love Bronson, but he's going to do...
He wants to do Wonder Woman.
Oh, God, well, his Wonder Woman...
You liked Bronson?
Yes.
What the fuck was it? I have no idea what...
let me tell you what. There's the use of classical music in that. That is the best use of classical music I've heard since Excalibur.
That guy's an idiot. That guy and that
Which guy, the director or the star?
Both.
Or both? Do you think the star of that should be Mad Max?
The star of that should... don't know.
Anyway.
All right, let's just end that right now. Let's just. I killed that conversation.
In England, there's a couple of movies out. Centurion, which is the new Neil Marshall.
Mm-hmm. How is that? Have you seen it or?
I haven't seen it, but I've heard good things about it.
All right, that's good.
And it sounds a lot better than bloody Robin Hood.
Anything's going to be better than Robin Hood right now. I mean, anything.
And made for a fraction of the cost. And then the other movie is Ricky Gervais's new movie, Cemetery Junction, which is kind of a very British movie, kind of more of a life story kind of picture rather than that other thing that he did.
Yeah.
Drew
Barrymore will direct a Wizard of Oz sequel called Surrender Dorothy.
Wait a second, though. How many Wizard of Oz are they? They have a couple Wizard of Oz things going on.
Well, I've heard about remakes.
Yeah, remakes, but a sequel.
Yeah.
Oh, just leave it alone already. I mean.
Well, actually, it's not a sequel. It seems like a real-life prequel. No. I don't know. I can't tell. They want Robert Downey Jr. in it. Hang on.
Well, there you go.
Robert Downey Jr. could star in the origin story, Oz the Great and Powerful. Surrender Dorothy is a different project. I remember years ago, Rod Steiger went on and on and on about how he wanted to direct Elizabeth Taylor in a sequel of Wizard of Oz. As Dorothy as an old woman. Older woman. I'm sorry, Elizabeth. Let's see.
Well, Robert Downey Jr. is going to be in it. We know it's going to be shit.
I know you're going to go heckle the shit out of that movie.
They won't say what it's about. I have no idea what Surrender Dorothy is about.
Maybe it's really about Judy Garland. Then maybe it's a movie about Judy Garland.
That could be. No, I don't know. I don't know.
Are you guys
going to
come to Persia?
We interviewed, well, Jamie interviewed the screenwriters.
Yeah, I didn't hear that.
You need to try listening to the show sometime, Roland. We love having you. We love having you on.
No, that's cool. Roland's busy. He's trying to make it happen.
I know the lead girl in that movie, Gemma.
Oh, you know her.
Gemma
Arterton.
She's the lead. She's a possible, and no joke, she has been, you know, a lot of that name, her name has been mentioned a lot to replace Megan Fox in the next Transformers movie.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, I'm not joking about that.
Her name has been mentioned a lot since they announced Megan Fox wasn't in it 2 hours ago.
Every website has posted the top seven girls that should, and her name keeps coming up.
Did you hear what I said?
No, I didn't. I don't know if I want to hear, but just go ahead and say it again.
They just announced that Megan Fox wasn't in it like 2 hours ago, dude.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Go look on the web. Everyone. Obviously, Megan Fox isn't popular with anybody.
Yeah. Did we talk about that Super 8 trailer? I think we did. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Man, we're running out of things to talk about. So, Law and Order is canceled. All right, that's it.
Okay.
Hey, Jean-Luc Godard premiered his what he calls his last movie. It's actually called Socialism.
Oh yeah,
but,
that's right.
He claims it's his last movie at this year's Cannes Film Festival, and people were wildly divided by it. Nobody understood it, and so you either, like all Godard films, you either embrace that or you don't. So critics are kind of divided both ways in that.
Well, we'll see what happens. It really is his last movie. He's not going to do anything.
That's what he says, but I mean, my God, he's in his 80s, you know?
I thought he was dead.
Yeah, I mean, most people probably do, because you think back of the Fellinis and the Bergmans and the Antonioni, and then you have Godard, and Godard's still around.
Yeah,
you know,
and Chabrol's still around, too. Claude Chabrol's still around. I mean, well, he's like Abe Vigoda, I guess. Everyone thought he's dead, but he's still alive. I mean, you know.
Yes, Jean-Luc Godard is like Abe Vigoda. That's...
Well, the way Roland is dead, I thought he was dead. I mean...
That's great. Oh man, that's great. Okay, I think that's about it. Iron Man 2 still beat out Robin Hood for the weekend box office. Is there a surprise there? You know, I just didn't know if people would actually be interested in Robin Hood. I never thought that they would be.
Well, here's the thing. Obviously, they thought, I mean, $225 million, that's a lot of money to put behind a movie that you're not sure there's an audience for. I mean, let's talk about a gamble. And obviously, a lot of people fell on their swords for this because Universal, there's a lot of turnover right now there. So, and they redid their whole entire release schedule for the next year and a half. They, like, switched everything around. So there's a lot of turmoil as we speak that they're trying to fix that. But $225 million for a period piece like this, I don't care how action-packed or lack of action really should be, that's an incredible gamble to take.
Yeah, I mean, that's the cost of wannabe blockbuster nowadays.
Yeah, yeah.
And Terrence Howard is going to play Marvin Gaye if everything turns out right. It's about time they make a Marvin Gaye biopic. Okay, I guess I'm alone on
that. Cameron Crowe is directing this one, right? This is one thing that he's been
Cameron Crowe actually announced his next film, and it's not that.
Wait, I thought he was working on that, though. I thought he was...
He might be.
Attached to it. That's why I say I wouldn't... What is his next film?
I'll look it up, but I can't. It's a very specific plot. It's unique. It's not like anything that he's done before.
Well, good for him.
But he's coming back to the screen, and I just had a conversation the other day. Where'd Cameron Crowe go since Elizabethtown?
He's working on a doc. I thought he's working on a documentary though too that he's been putting together.
He seems like a natural. Is it a music documentary?
Yeah, I think so. So he's been
Or something on Billy Wilder. You know, those
His
two
subjects.
His
book of interviews with Billy Wilder is fantastic. I love that
book. Right, right.
But Elizabethtown, wasn't with that Orlando Bloom?
Orlando Bloom not being a pirate or an elf, yes.
Oh, he's a wanker as well.
Hey, wasn't his house broken into by the celebrity? The guy who was robbing the celebrities or whatever, wasn't his house broken into?
I think it was, yeah. We have a caller, 651 area code. I'm bringing it up now. 651?
Probably Danny Jr.
It probably is.
651, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. This is Janie McCormick. How are you tonight? Hi.
Great.
okay, what I wanted to do was I just want to say I was listening to you guys talk, and I was bouncing around here and seeing this screenwriters, and so when I see this, that you know, the Prince and you guys anyway, but what you're talking about. Anyway, and what happened to me was that I lived in Las Vegas back, 1960.
Uh-huh.
I was there when Frank and Dean and them guys made Ocean's 11.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, well, anyway, so I've had like three people. I wrote a book about my life story with a helper, a lady that helped me write it, and it's called Breaking My Silence.
Uh-huh.
And I lived in Vegas for 13 years, and I wrote this book about Vegas and my childhood. So anyway, let me make a long story short. Did you ever hear of a guy named Lou Ippolito?
That name rings a bell, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Remember Lou Ippolito? He was Fat Andy in Goodfellas?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you remember that? And do you remember what happened to him? He ended up in prison for life for 8 murders, assisted murders, while he was a police officer in New York on the police force.
Right.
He was working for the mob.
Mm-hmm. Is
this
a mafia cop, right?
Yeah, mafia cop. Remember he wrote Mafia Cop,
yeah,
and then he wrote
that.
And then they made the book, The Brotherhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And they told all about the story. Well, anyway, I'm Janie McCormick. I'm the lady that he wrote he conned me out of $45,000 to write my movie script.
Ooh.
I mean,
wow, okay.
Lou Ippolito did. Lou Ippolito wrote my movie script.
I'm not a stranger to this kind of thing. My brother was an aspiring screenwriter in Los Angeles for a long time, so we're not strangers to this kind of mess.
Wow.
What a mad world, huh?
Yeah, I feel for you. Trust me.
So people can purchase your book, and they purchase your book at breakingmysilence.net?
Yeah, breakingmysilence.net. .net. Yeah, how did you know that? You must see it on the computer.
Yes, I'm a fast researcher.
He's the best. Like the Flash. He's the best.
He's quick. Anyway, listen to this one. Then there's another guy comes along, and he's going to write my story, right? And this guy's in Toronto, Canada. And he's going to make my movie, and he's gonna call it a Party Girl for the Rat Pack. And then he said, this guy was with Toronto Pictures in Toronto, Canada. So anyway, he comes along, and he's going to do it. But then he sends me a contract that my attorney out here says, no way, you can't sign that. You're going to sign everything away. So then I couldn't do that. It's like, I'm telling you, honey, it's like, don't even mention you're going to make my movie. No.
but have you attempted since you wrote your own story in a book form, have you attempted to write your own screenplay of your life?
You know, that isn't that the way it should be? I should just adventure into the whole dang on world, huh?
Yeah, you know it better than anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I do. I mean, you know, when you live it, you know it real well.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I bet. I mean, it's a colorful. I can see why people would be interested in hearing your story. I mean, it's
very colorful. Yeah, it was very colorful. I had a lot of fun. Matter of fact, you don't believe this one. You know the Globe magazine?
Yeah.
You know, the scandal rag of the world?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Globe gets a hold of me and says, I'll give you $1,000 if you tell me the story about Jerry Lewis. So I said, well, why not? I'm not making any money anywhere else. So you know what they did to me? Listen to this. They made me go down and take a lie detector test. The Globe.
They cared if you were lying or not?
Yeah, I mean, really,
do you believe that? Yeah, was I lying about Jerry and I together? No.
On their part, I mean...
No. I mean, but let me tell you, the Globe, you know, I mean, what are they publicizing that everybody's doing everybody? I mean, you know, they how they are.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I actually had to go downtown to this biz office down here and actually be tested for lie detector test. And in the Globe thing, it says, she passed the lie detector test. No kidding.
Wow. I mean, why would you lie about being intimate with Jerry Lewis?
Yeah, really.
No, yeah, really. Really? How could you lie about that? How old is he now? 90?
He's still
alive, doing good, I guess. Bless his heart. He's a sweetheart, though.
Yeah.
He was a really wonderful guy.
You had a lot of experiences, I say that word, with the Rat Pack.
Oh, yes. I know Frank inside and out. I'm 69 years old now. I love saying that number, 69. I'm 69 years old now, and I was only 18 then. So.
Wow.
It was a wild time in Vegas.
And they owned Vegas. I mean, carte blanche, right?
That was their
town. Honey, they owned it. Yeah, wherever they went, the doors were open.
Do you have it? My favorite all-time entertainer is actually Sammy Davis Jr. Do you have any stories about
him?
Oh,
God, was he great? Wasn't Sammy just the absolute limit? I mean, that guy could just do anything, man. He could do cartwheels, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, his little legs were just like rubber. And he was so talented. He could dance. He could sing. He could, you know, he could do it all. I never did anything with Sammy, but, you know, he was a lot of fun to be around and be with. I partied with those guys. And with Frank and Dean and Sammy, those were, to me, that's the Rat Pack.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, they used to be called the Klan until Sammy came along, and then they decided they couldn't call themselves the Klan anymore.
You really couldn't, not with Sammy, you really couldn't for, you know. No.
And then how mad Frank got when Kennedy wouldn't stay with him in he extended his home, you know, built on an addition for John Kennedy to stay with him.
Yes, that's right. Mm.
Yeah, and then he got so, he was so ticked. He was so upset. He got caught, you know, with what's his name? Cal Neiman got caught on the out on the tarmac with, what was it, Gene Connor or whatever his name was, one of those mob guys. And Kennedy said, I can't be seen with you, Matt. He said, I can't be seen with you. I'm with Frank when this is all happening. I mean, it's a laugh a minute. I mean,
yeah. Well, do you have a show on Blog Talk Radio at all? I know that you've been on Blog Talk Radio in the past, but
no, I've been on a lot of shows and stuff, and I've been on TV out in Vegas and everything.
Right.
Yeah, because of Louis Alito.
You should have your own show. I think
I should.
Yeah, you really should.
I should, huh? But how do I do that?
Well, I have no idea. I don't even know how we have this show.
In other words, I could do it then.
you could definitely do it.
Hey, you could definitely do something. There must be like, I mean, you could definitely have your own cable show in Vegas. There's got to be like, you know, whatever the local channels are. You should definitely have, I mean, right there, just what we've heard in the last 10 minutes.
Well, we will direct people to breakingmysilence.net.
Yeah,
oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I'll sell a book, eh?
And I'm interested. I'm gonna buy the book.
Oh, good. I'll make sure, honey. I'll make sure I address something real fun to you.
Thank you, Jean.
Thank you so much. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me on, honey. It's been a slice.
Thank you, babe.
Okay, sweetie. Bye bye.
Good night. Is Roland?
Well, Roland, Roland, you are no longer the most energetic person on the show.
Roland, what happened to you? I was hoping you would say something.
Roland, you're so quiet back there.
I had you on speakerphone. I was doing the washing up.
Roland, what's the next movie you're looking forward to seeing?
Oh, I can't think of any.
Centaur.
Okay. Well, on that note.
That was great. But you want to see Centaurin, though, when that opens here, right?
Who?
Centaurin, you know, the Neil Marshall movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know when that's going to get a release.
I heard July or August.
Well, let me tell you, if this critic of our show fell asleep during the last act of tonight's program, there's something seriously wrong with him.
He has narcolepsy.
Because this is not a dull section here.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to play Film Score to play us out.
Cool.
I just don't know which one yet.
Just pick one, dude. Russian roulette, man. Just pick
so
one.
So many to choose from. It should be something, you know, in honor of our movie, the movie that we cover tonight with our interviews, I'll play this one to close this out, and I won't reveal it until the next show. We'll be back Sunday. We were supposed to have Neil Jordan, and Neil Jordan canceled on us.
Oh, man.
So start boycotting Neil Jordan movies.
Okay. All right. Mm.
It's a good film. It's playing in festivals. And is it on demand?
It is on demand. It is on, check your listing, your local cable provider, but it is on demand.
Ondine?
It's a good movie. I really liked it.
It's Ondine, starring Colin Farrell.
Where did you go see it?
I was mailed it.
Okay.
I saw it on demand, so, yeah.
I think it was out in the UK a while ago.
Yeah. Okay. The only reason why I'm pausing is because I'm trying to get back to the switchboard where I can play this music.
Yeah, I was wondering.
Sorry. Hang on. All right. It's back up. All right, gentlemen. But we'll be back Sunday night to talk about whatever we like to talk about. And don't forget about our upcoming June series where we celebrate the summer of 1985. That was Roland's favorite year in film. And we'll talk to people like Joe Dante and Leah Thompson, Bob Gale, Steve Guttenberg. It's going to be a good series. And we also submitted to Cimino and Mickey Rourke. Do you think we'll have luck there, Roland?
Oh, if you got Mickey Rourke, that'd be so funny.
Yeah. I mean, we can air it during the first part of the show, and then you can call in and ask us what he talked about. Okay. All right, we close off with our mystery movie theme of the week. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. See you Sunday night. Bye, guys.
Bye.
See you guys tonight. Bye.